first two cases of Bata Diva that he felt that they were Chashad al Arayah, for example. And we said that in truth they really were not guilty, but in terms of appearances, they may have engaged in certain activities which could be misconstrued. In other words, he didn't give them the benefit of the doubt. He found himself in an identical situation where he was totally innocent, but the situation was such that it was misconstrued and he was not judged without proof. And he did the same thing with the similar situation with the Reb Menachah. They weren't sufficiently medaktek, as he demanded that they ought to do. That he lacked a certain type of a sympathy for human weakness, so to speak, or for the fact that people weren't on his level of meticulousness and so on and so forth. But that doesn't mean to say that you have a right to judge them. He was too harsh with them. Because that's something that great people have to be on guard against. That is to say, they may have a lack of sympathy for human weakness. I may not be able to see that people have tremendous potential, but you just have to be more patient with them. You need a different approach with them. The only thing is, we're saying now that the other issue, that he accused them of calling the Bnei Hashpacha Avadim. He brought back that report that they disparaged their brothers who were from the Shpachos, and that he was punished, that he himself was an Eved, was sold as an Eved. It's not so clear to see the connection between that. That's difficult, because you would think that if he was guilty of, the way it normally works is that you experience the very same thing that you tried to do to somebody else. So then now you know what it feels like. I mean, on a simple level. A punishment which is neither connected to me, that means the person is extremely insensitive to somebody else. Somebody else's situation. So he now finds himself in the same situation. Now he can identify with it. And now he can be tshuva. That seems to be a simplistic but classical mode. But in this case, there's something missing, because it wasn't that he was being insensitive. Quite the contrary. It seems that he was sensitive to the brothers, to their pain, that they should not be mistreated. That they shouldn't be mistreated because they were the Bnei Hashpachos. So, if anything, if he's being unfair to the brothers, that's one thing. And falsely suspecting them, that's one thing. But if anything, that he himself has to experience the humiliation of being an Eved, that doesn't seem to fit the crime, because here he seems to be prompted by the fact that he was concerned that their feelings should not be hurt. So that's the challenge that this particular one opposes for us. And that the accusation is a serious one. A serious character flaw. I mean, Malbim Pnei Chavero, the Rabbim, it's a serious thing to deprecate your fellow to the grave, right? To treat lightly, embarrass a fellow Jew is a very serious avera. In terms of your, first of all, in terms of yourself, it indicates that you're on a very low level, indulging your own ego in a crazy kind of a way, and also you're harming another person. It's the worst harm. To damage somebody psychologically, clearly that's the biggest thing, to hurt somebody psychologically than physically. Because physically you get cured, and that's it, but psychologically you really hurt the person. And you mentally cannot function in it as well. So that's why we should be much more concerned about psychological harm, which people are not, by the way. People that wouldn't think of hurting a fly wouldn't hurt a person physically. They're extremely careful about that. But with words, people don't adopt the same approach. It's an interesting kind of thing. Words are much more harmful than many other forms of physical harm. But people are not that concerned about the words. In fact, a lot of people take their pleasure in that, pride, that they're so sharp. A sharp word, I really put them in a place. People are happy about that when they really feel they got somebody. But, well, if it's justified, it's justified. But if it's not justified, then you're really inflicting pain upon somebody. More serious pain, because I think we all know that the worst pain we suffer is the mental pain, especially, emotionally when you're embarrassed or when you're, somebody really insulted, when you're insulted, to be insulted is a very serious form of suffering for a person. And he has, insofar as it affects the mind and it puts you in a bad mood and makes you depressed, it causes more damage than you know, accidentally you cut yourself. So it's painful. You put a band-aid on, but it doesn't necessarily interfere with your true functioning. So let's get it straight. What Yosef was accusing his brothers of was very serious. Gross, not just insensitivity, but that's beyond that. But in point of fact, they were putting the brothers down. So, first of all, you have to know, well, again, the same question, was it true or wasn't it true? But the fact that he, as a result of this, he himself was sold as an Eved is very difficult to understand, because he was trying to protect the brothers. That question as to why Yosef sold Yaakov and why he didn't tell the brothers is a valid question. And that, with regard to that, and of course you have to raise the issue of the motivation of Yosef. With regard to that, I don't think it poses such a problem. I think that at this point in time, Yosef was the younger one, the youngest, and I don't think he felt that he was in a position to affect the brothers. I don't think he had that kind of relationship. It says, you see that he piled around B'nai B'lov and B'nai Zilpah. We do see there was some kind of hierarchy over here. It's a family, it's still a human family. You have, 12 boys and one girl. And there was a hierarchy. Let's face it. You see, that's why the Pasuk points out that he fell in with this group. B'nai B'lov and B'nai Zilpah, which does indicate that the other brothers did hold themselves aloof. To a certain extent, they held themselves aloof. They were separate. There was a bit of an elite. And I don't think that Yosef was wrong about that. I don't think Yosef could have just gone to them and given them reviews. I don't think they would have accepted. He was a kid. I think he realized that, and I think that's true. And therefore, he felt that the only way to solve the problem was to go to his father. You can do with the Ramban. There's Ramban now. Let's take a look at the Ramban for a moment. The Ramban, by the way. Take a look at the Ramban. Hunar es b'nei doha. He quotes Rashi, show you, Otamas and Aros. Namash nech b'yeinu v'masach and b'sara. All right, he engaged in childish activities. Vanity. Es b'nei doha. Paloma. Verogo es b'nei doha. He used to hang out, so to speak, with the b'nei doha. The fi shahayu echav m'vaz and otan, because the brothers would humiliate them, embarrass them, but who would come on? And then of course, keep us on the heart. Kol Ra Shai Ro, B'yechav B'nei Ro, Yehoi Ma'ak, B'yev Lash Menashi. Okay. At the end of quote. The Yenkein, Ramban says, Lama Lo Hishiluhu B'nei Asfaka. He asked a good question. He asked a good question. If that's the case, that there was this division between the B'nei Asfaka and the B'nei Leia, and Yosef sided with them, and the other brothers didn't advise with them. So doesn't it stand to reason that they would come to his rescue? At the time, they would fight, they would make some advice. If that's the case, then he was abandoned by those he was trying to protect. You can't say, since Rashi makes clear that the evil report all concerns B'nai Leah, according to Rashi. Who owe those some? He loved them, and Makarvan, and Makarvan, and Makarvan, and Makarvan, and Makarvan, and he even complained, he fought their battle. More than just that he was Makarvan. But he fought their battle and complained. He complained to the father about the fact that they were being embarrassed. So why would the B'nai HaSachos, the other brothers that hated him because of the favoritism and so forth? And then it says, I'll be Basam, Rashi says. See, Rashi says afterwards. So let's go back to the Pasuk for a second. It says that, take a look at the Sukkim. Then it says, Yisrael, Ohad, it's Yosef and Kolbanov. That Yaakov loved Yosef more than all of his sons. He bends the Sunim Hulo. Because he was Benjamin. The Ashlot son of Papa. Alright, let me discuss that. That he did an act which demonstrated the faith of him. Vayiru Echav, and the brother saw, the Oso Ahav Aviyah Mikal Echav, that the fathers loved him more than all the brothers. Clearly, I mean, it's the reference when they saw. Until the giving of the coat, it could be denied. I mean, it's not just the action of giving the coat, obviously. You can tell when somebody has a favor. But, if it's not blatant, If it's just a suspicion, so then you can deal with it. But now it became blatant. Vayisro, so they hated him, Vayochu Gabarushalom. And they couldn't speak civilly to him. Which Rashi, by the way, points out that that shows, even though it's a criticism, in the criticism you see a virtue. And that is that they were wrong for hating him for something like this. They should have been able to deal with it. Of course, we have to ask ourselves the question, how should they have been able to deal with it? It seems to be the fault of Yaakov. So one question is, why is it wrong of them to have this reaction? I mean, is it legitimate for children to hate the brother who they feel is unfairly being favored by the father? Seems to be the fault of Yaakov. And yet, the pasuk points out, though, of course, Rashi, a virtue of theirs, and that is the Layachul Dab Vashalom. They have two things. That is praising them. That given, even if it was wrong to hate, but given that they made a mistake in that area, but their mode of behavior was the correct one. And that is that they were not two-faced people. They were not hypocritical. As many people, as just like in our society today, you know, people will act one way to your face, and then there's behind your back. Because they want to retain the benefits of the social approval and so on and so forth. So they're to your face. They don't want you to be an enemy. So they'll act one way as though they really like you. But behind your back, they'll speak against you. Here the brothers were honest. It shows that they were honest people. Maybe they were wrong for disliking him, but once they disliked him, they didn't try to hide it. That's it. They refused to be told. That's what the Rashi says. That's their praise. Take a look at Hay, because Hay is very, very interesting. You tell me what you find interesting about Hay. Vayachlom Yosef Chalom, and Yosef dreamed the dream. Vayagi Vayachav, and he told it to his brother. Vayosifu Oth, and El Oth. And they hated him even more. Now, what's difficult about that? Eli notices something very, very sharp, and that is that at this point in time, he hadn't even told him their dream. It seems pretty obvious in the prison what they hate him for. For having a dream? Didn't tell him the dream. Vayagi doesn't mean the dream. I'll tell you why, because then take a look at Bob. Then Vayomale, and he said to them, Shimuna, Hachalom, Azeh, Shechalom,
Bibi. So you're saying all the time?
Apparently. Yeah. And he told him. Then apparently Shimuna, they didn't want to listen. Let's see. I mean, because he has to Shimuna. And in other words, the reaction to just telling him that he had a dream was that of hatred. They hated him just for the fact that he had a dream. And apparently it would seem that they weren't interested. Because why is the prophet have to bring that, you know, what he said, he told him he had a dream or not? It's too much detail for the Torah, normally. But he refers to you that he's had a dream. And then please listen to the dream. You can just get to the point. The point is, he told them the dream, and they didn't like it. Hamaloch Timloch. They didn't like that. That's because of the nuance of the premise over here. But the Torah is pointing out that first he told them that he had a dream, and they hated him for that piece of information, the Tayagi. Then my Yom, he said, please listen to the dream that I dreamed. He's really insisting on that. At first they listened, I think it's safe to the police, so they didn't want to even hear it. And he had asked me, Al Malum Masochasada, and the old, many tells me the dream, that we were gathering our sheaves, our bundles, let's see the term bundles, in the middle of the field. Vihine Kama Alumasi, the Gamni Tava, and behold, my bundle stood up and also remained standing. And behold, your bundle surrounded my bundle, and bowed down to my bundle. Okay? Vayamilo, let's take a look at Klesh now and see what's a little bit difficult about this part. Vayamilo, Echav, and the brother said to him, Amalok Timlo Chalenu, will you be the king over us? In Mashal Timcho Bundle, or will you rule over us? Vayasifu Oud, no, also. And they hated him even more. They continued, they increased their hatred to him. Al Chalamosav, the Aldebar, concerning his, because of his dreams and because of his words. Now, what is Bar over here? What's Bar over here? To Rashi, it's Al Dibasam Ra, sorry, maybe over here. It was because of the bad report. Of course, the question then is, it seems, the question is like this, did they hate him because of the Diba or didn't they? When the Torah reports to us about the fact that he brought the Diba Ra, the bad report, it doesn't mention that they hated him for that. Okay? It's only when the Torah tells about the dream It seems in response to the dream, the behavior to the dream, that's now the behavior to the big one. Whereas prior to that, it doesn't seem to behavior to that. I mean, the question is, why would the dream, what effect did the dream have in producing a hatred to the diva? It seems to be completely unconnected. Yet, according to Rashi, that's the meaning of the term. So, hatred for his dreams and for his report, his bad report. Well, that should have been something independent. Why did they hate him? Why did they have such a reaction? Let's just get some more questions out of them. Of course, the first question he said was, before they even heard the dream, they hated him. Why do you hate a person for having a dream? In other words, also the reaction, he tells them the dream. Well, also, another question is, why did he tell them the dream? What was his purpose in telling them the dream altogether? And why did they have such a strong reaction to the dream? Why did they have such a strong reaction? I mean, I don't think you get it. In the next case, with the next dream, you see the reaction of Yaakov. Yaakov even rebukes him for having a dream. What is this? He gives him an argument. But that itself is a problem. How can you give a person an argument having a dream? No matter how crazy the dream is. I can't see anyone ever getting angry at someone for having a dream, no matter how crazy that dream might be. I mean, I don't think that's something which is your fault. Now, right, let's say if I told you I had a dream, and in that dream, you know, your whole family was wiped out and you were told, the worst possible thing you could ever imagine. Of course, it wouldn't be pleasant, but I don't think you can get angry at me for having a dream. I mean, if you consider me to be an enemy in general, that's one thing, but you get, and you say, what do you mean? It's not my fault. I don't control my own dreams. Because very often you have dreams in which you suffer yourself. You have nightmares. You have dreams that are terrifying, where horrible things happen to you yourself. So I think we all recognize that no one is to be blamed. If a person had a dream, it would be dropped a nuclear bomb over Israel and destroyed the Jewish people. I mean, we'd find it a little strange. I don't think you could put that triumphant to things. What are you going to do? Ostracize the man? Right? Alright, we say, well, what caused the person to have this dream? Fine. But you cannot fault the person. To the best of my knowledge, there's no system in the world in which a person is punished for a dream. We have a thing called kindness tolerance. People have kindness. Yeah. But I never heard of any judicial system in which a person is to be punished. And yet Yosef said, yeah, the brothers were acting, they were punishing him for a dream. They were, in a sense, punishing him. In a sense, in fact, they were, because later on, that's the fact that they decided to kill him because of his dream. Right? Bahine Balachalamos Bah, the Balachalamos. Then Mira, let us put him in the pit, right? And we'll say that we'll make up a story, whatever it is. And Venira, Ma'iya Chalamosa, we'll see what happens to his dream. So, in other words, I think it's very clear that what they were doing was punishing him for his dreams. And that itself is astounding. Because how can you punish a person for dreams? The key question over here is in that first puzzle. The question is, why did Yosef want to tell the dream to the brothers? And why did the brothers have such a strong reaction to the mere fact that he told them that he had a dream? Which, you know, on the surface seems to be a very normal activity. Everybody has dreams. The foundation of everything that follows is to be found over here. Clearly, Yosef was not telling over his dreams, you know, to amuse people. Or because he believed that if he dreams something, so therefore it's going to be true, because I dream something. Some people have that's like a superstitious kind of feeling. A person has a dream that he, let's say a person is about to go on a trip. So you look at, let's say, it just happened to you. I mean, it's an interesting question. Let's say, some of you guys are planning a trip. I hope what I'm saying now will not affect your dream. Suggestibility plays a role there. But let's say you're going on a certain airplane, you have the number, the flight number. Now in your dream, the night before, you dream about this. Yes. And the flight, etc., and then the explosion, and you're on the plane. Now, and that's it. That's the whole thing, you wake up. Would this in any way, shape, or form affect your plan? Would you then change the plan? You did a little experiment with airplane people. If they were going on a flight the night before, they had a dream, which is very same flight, explodes with them on it, would it cause them to change their plan? Most people indicated that they wouldn't. but there was a lot of hesitation there. Maybe it wouldn't be as comfortable as the room we would do. Maybe some, and Warren Mel says that he would actually change his life. I don't know whether that's the rational thing to do or not, but I mean, it does indicate that people do feel that there's something to dream. No, I mean, the question is, when Yosef, you have to ask yourself, how did Yosef use this dream? How did he view the dream? And what was his purpose in telling it to the brothers? Well, that's crucial. In other words, there's no doubt that Yosef did not view this as being an ordinary dream. But we know that there's different forms in which another receives prophecy, and one of them is the Chalom HaLayla. So, I mean, you see that in the case of Abimelech, see that in the case of Pharaoh. They were not Nevi'im, but God did communicate to them. Yosef was on the level of Nevi'im. He was a Navi. But he could interpret the dreams. He could interpret it. Now, we know that Yosef had the capacity to interpret dreams. So therefore, he was in a position to decide whether a dream was just an ordinary dream or whether it was a dream of Nevi'im. Later on, we see when the brothers came down from the throne, and he recognized them. He says, "Yisgar Sachalama." He remembered the dream, the Sachalama. So clearly, and then he put his plan into action. The plan that he had with regard to them is based upon the fact that he remembered the dream. So clearly, he regarded the dream as having prophetic significance. Okay. Now, of course, the question still remains, even if that is the case. What's the purpose in telling it to the brother? Okay? Now, we can now understand the reaction of the brother. Because when he said to them, Vayagilech, we told the brother, what did he tell them? He didn't tell them that he had a dream, because no one said if he had a dream or not. But he told them that he had a dream which was of prophetic significance. Which means he was in fact making the claim that God has communicated something significant about the future to me in my dream. Okay? Now that already produced a certain reaction in them. And what was the reaction that it produced? A reaction of hatred. Why? Because they disputed it. In other words, they did not consider him to be on that level. They thought that he was some type of an egomaniac. That he was a distorted type of a person. And that was beginning to unfold. As I said, it's difficult to understand how they came to a position, an attitude where they felt they had to kill him. But you see that there's a process of development. They thought that he was, first of all, they thought that he was a defective type of character. He had serious character flaws. So it's a behavior when the father, it was, a lot of it had to do with the fact that the father favored him, true. But again, they wouldn't hate a person. They felt it was a tzaddik. They wouldn't have hated him. But they felt that makes it worse. When the father favors someone, and he obviously is a flawed person, that means that, you know, that he's fooling the father. He's fooling everybody. But they definitely viewed him as being an individual who had serious character flaws. So actually, they disliked him. They disliked him. They didn't want anything to do with him. That's their praise. But then, you see, the Torah is depicting for us a process of development. Because left at that stage, the Torah is not providing with the causes. So what? So they're not going to kill him. At this point in time, they're not going to kill him. They didn't kill him because they envied the favoritism. But things get out of hand. The first step was, see, the hatred now goes through a transformation. That's what Vayosifu is telling you about how this hatred, which began because of a simple emotional type of a thing, that he was the favorite, is transformed now. Events occur that given that predisposition they had towards Yosef, they now begin to interpret everything in accordance with that view. And the fact that he claims to them that he has a dream of significance, a prophetic dream, is another cause of hatred right there, because they don't view him as being on that level. So that means to say that he's more seriously distorted. He's a very distorted person. He's a megalomaniac. Person who's a little crazy. That's why they didn't want to listen. That's why they didn't want to listen. I'm like, this is nonsense. This is crazy. Then, but he we'll get to why he wants to be held up to drink. He made a mistake, but his purpose was not to stick it to them, to make them feel good. That was not his purpose. He made a mistake. See, the essential mistake of Yosef at this point is with regard to his relationship to others. He was completely lacking in Aesop, in political faith. He had no sense of the attitude of the brothers and how to deal with them. You see? He was completely blind, and this very blindness, which was brought about by certain emotions, led to his downfall. He then has to say, but Shimon, no, he should have left it at that. You see? Mistake after mistake. He would have been better off had he left it at that. Okay, I'll take it back. You learn a lot from this and how to deal with it. You have to gauge and engage their reaction. You engage their reaction and then understand it. He thought that just the opposite, that people would go, here's a dream and things will improve.
Right.
Yeah, they'll really enjoy it. They'll be very happy to hear it. Now, when they heard it, it's worse when you actually hear the dream. Okay? It's worse. If people think that this person really, you know, has these feelings about himself, overestimates himself, that's one thing. But then when you hear the actual content of what he really believes, that he's going to be the ruler and the leader, yeah, then it gets worse. You see? So then, he said he told them the dream. Okay. Now, why did they get upset about the dream? Why? Not my question of names, I mean, it's just a dream. Either or they did not. Now, in my opinion, they clearly did not. If they were convinced that this was a prophecy, then they would have had to accept it. They may not have liked it, but then that would be confirmation, divine confirmation that Yosef indeed is fit to rule, whatever. And then you have to look at him in an entirely different way. You've got to revise your attitude towards him. You've got to look at him in an entirely different way. And then everything has to change. Your whole relationship has to change. And perhaps that's why Yosef wanted to communicate with him. Convinced as he was that this was truth, this would therefore, if the brother accepted it as truth, would bring about a change in the nature of the relationship. And after all, I'm sure they all had a sense of destiny that they were involved in the building of Klal Yisrael. So therefore it made sense from his vantage point to communicate this to them. Of course he was wrong. But that might have been his objective. Now, since they did not believe that he was fit for prophecy, since they believed he was a flawed character, they regarded this dream from a different angle. That this is really an expression of his emotional desire. And the fact that he chooses to tell to us means that he doesn't look at it that way. He doesn't believe an indication, a portent of what is to come. If that's the case, so then they really now it's a different kind of increase. There's a quantitative increase and a qualitative increase. It changes the whole picture. In other words, now we didn't look at it this way before. Before we just didn't like it. But now it's a different kind of hatred. It's the hatred of someone who you regard as being a serious man. As being a serious destructive force. That's why I would say now it activated the hatred over the diva. Before they looked at the diva in a different light. So it's just an expression of childish emotions, of base emotions. But now that you see this individual has plans of grandeur, so now he's a threat to us. It's another thing also if this person just has dreams of greatness. So he's a defective person. But if his plan was to go off into Africa and the continent of Africa, so yes, good luck to you. But the Amalos Kimlos Aleinu, all of his dreams had to do with them. There was the ruler and the ruled, the conqueror and the conquered, and it happens to be that we are the conquerors. Amalos Kimlos Aleinu, Hamashal Kimshal Bado. What does that mean, by the way? What's the Torah teaches? These are the same thing, just two different words. What's the meaning of that? One would have been enough, but there's two things. One is to be the melon. Just to be the melon. A malach kimach aleinu,
Who are you to be the monarch? This is a, I mean, maybe some banana republic you could be the king, but this is probably well, and now for us. That itself is a record. That's a tremendous amount of chutzpah on your part to think that you have all the qualities to be a melech to yourself. Who are you? That's one thing. In Moshe Kinshol Banim is another thing. And that is that we're going to allow our lives to be ruled by you. You're going to have power over us. Moshe means Manshala, rule. Two separate ideas. Okay? Then it seems to say that explains that the Vayosifu, there were two Vayosifu. The first one, interesting, before they even heard the dream, the mere fact that this person is a dreamer, that is to say that he has dreams which he really believes are a portentous of what is to come, that he's on the level of God communicating. They didn't want to listen. So when they heard the actual content of Sela's voice, they should have stopped at that point. They said, okay, it's nothing. Yosef was traveling down a path over here. He was creating his own doom, which is always the case. Most of the around here is always the person. You say even Yosef HaTzadik, even great people. I mean, when you find yourself in new situations, you always have to look at yourself. What did I do? And that is the first phase. And you now view him in a totally different light. He is a dangerous individual. He's a megalomaniac individual. And he really believes that he's been chosen by God to implement his plan. But nevertheless, he doesn't learn from this. That answers the question that I started out with, is that how can you punish somebody for his dream? And I started out with that question. I said, it's unheard of. Yet the brothers did punish him. They didn't punish him for the dream. They punished him because of the type of person that he was, that they regarded him as being a very serious threat due to the fact that he regarded his dream as having prophetic significance, which indicated that he was prepared to act on that. And if that is the case, then he posed in their minds a very serious threat to them in their future. It gives you a basis for understanding that what they did was based upon decisions that they made regarding Yosef, not based upon emotions. Of course, underneath all of this, there were certain emotions, therefore they did come to a false conclusion. Didn't have to be the question. That's why what they did was wrong. Yeah, but it gives you, they put that sin that they committed in an entirely different light. Combined with this, B'nai, plain shot, he says, B'nai es B'nai Bilav yes B'nai Zilpa. Okay? He says, V'hu nar, V'hu es B'nai Bilav, yes B'nai Zilpa, Nishayov, Yomar, you nar. The flow of the passage is that he was young, he was a youth, and es B'nai Bilav yes B'nai Zilpa. I mean, plain shot, he says. Yamak Yunar, the who in the name Bilah, the name Zupa, Nishayav is coming. And he was constantly with the children of Bilah, the sons of Bilah and Zupa. Well, he carried Mayhem, he never separated from them, but Bruna Arusa, because he was young. In other words, he sort of clung to them. Kilahem Siva Vihem, she is Peru, he shall too. Because the father commanded them to guard him and take care of him. Lo, was the Hajira. Not to be to the older son. For who may be mehem divaru al aviyam? Well, the saying is to u elohar ba'achim. And he brought evil reports about them to the father, and therefore these brothers hate him. But nevertheless, what he's saying, the plain shot seems to be, the plain shot, I don't know that Rashi means just the plain shot. The plain shot seems to be, makes sense, that he was the youngest. And since there was this division among the brothers, the senior brothers were from the Nehlev. In age, and I guess in seniority, they had something, they're human, there's a certain feeling of seniority. Then next, in age, was the B'nai Shfachos, and they also didn't have the same credentials. So there is that possibility, there is that tendency to look down upon them. Because everybody has this feeling of being an elite, of being superior. And then you had Yosef. And Yosef is the younger one. It's also, I mean, this possibility, you see that Reuven, for example, who was the Bechor, was very upset about the fact that his mother was, in his mind, you know, was mistreated. You know, the whole incident with the bed, removing the bed, right? You know, the whole incident. When Yaakov died, Bilbil must have other, right? He switched the bed. And according to Chazal, that was a sin of Reuven. He's really, really condemned very harshly for that. That when Rachel died, so Yaakov then set his bed, so to speak, in the tent of her Shifra, who was Bilhah. And then this really upset Reuven. He identified torn elbow and emo. He couldn't take the humiliation of his mother. So he removed it, and he started to, you know, he wanted to place Yaakov's bed in the tent of his mother Leah. This was a humiliation to her. But now she was being overshadowed by someone who was a shikhar. And for that, he was severely punished. Just for that. The Torah depicted as though he had relations by Yishtel, that he actually slept with her. But that's not to be taken literally. But in all events, the plain shot makes sense that who would be able to be with? Those who were closest to him, nay, and so forth. Now, according to Rashi, he then was critical of the older brothers for being mezalzel, you know, for putting down the bnei shifra. Why did he punish for that? And why did he? Why did he sell an ever for that? And in fact, what was wrong with it? What was supposed to? Can't buy and allow this to happen. I want to suggest that he brought back the various reports. Essentially, they all partake of one defect, and that is due to the fact that he had this feeling of greatness. He did have a sense of greatness. So his purpose was not to bring down the brothers. His purpose was for the right purpose, but you have to be aware. Sometimes a person, because of his zealousness, is lacking a certain sympathy towards others and tends to judge them exceedingly harshly. That's what he was doing here. Therefore, in a sense, he was criticizing them. He was, negating them. Now, Chazal said like this, that sometimes when a person criticizes somebody else, and it's not fair, it's not accurate, there's a statement of Chazal, Kol ha-posel, mimumo posel. Did you hear that expression? That whoever criticizes, and it's really unwarranted, very often it stems from his own defect. He's projecting his own defect onto others. You see people in the community, etc. Whenever a person takes up a real pet cause and he's hollering about draft, about this, about that, very often it's an attempt to, in his own mind, to hide, you know, something that he himself is partaking. He likes to criticize people about the very thing because he's trying to deny it within himself. Now, I'm suggesting there's a possibility. Since it is possible, perhaps, that Yosef too has these feelings of superiority. In other words, let us assume like this, that the brothers in reality, I don't think that they were, anything they did over here was that open. Okay? It means that brothers, the way they talk to each other and so on and so forth, sometimes they put the other guy down. And again, it's just he was holding them to a very high standard, and he was misinterpreting what they were doing. Clearly, I don't think that they were low-level individuals that would call them names and indulge in that type of behavior overtly. But they they weren't as careful as he would like them to be. Okay? But maybe on this one it's different, and that is to say that he toppled the brothers here. He disqualified them. He impugned them. And the accusation was that they called the brothers, they're the ones who are Bali Lashon Hara, who look down. They're elitists. They have this false sense of being elitist. And they put other people down. Now, it could be that to a certain extent, the reason why he became focused on that was maybe that he himself partook about that, because he hung out with the B'nai Hashpacha. And maybe he also had
at that point in his life had not worked that feeling through, or that feeling of superiority, that he was that they were above him, but it could be. If that is the case, then it would resolve the, in other words, then he and being sold, to the extent that he, it is a punishment for him, because it was really, he should have realized that it's his own defect, that he has the same defect that he's talking about. And that by being put in that same situation, then he's forced to confront that. This would be, there'd be like three things over here. That the Rashi mentioned the three things would indicate three defects of Lashon Hara, of Dibas Rav. One is that it's Parsel, the Numa Parsel. You should look into yourself. That in the fact that you're focusing on certain behaviors and others, certain defects, is a sign that you may have that same defect yourself. Secondly, there is the fact that it indicates a failure with regard to your fellow man in being down with Kapsur, in the case of Hashuvim. In other words, that you can't judge a person on a superficial basis. And you always have to utilize certain principles. Just because you wouldn't do it, just because your standards are different, that doesn't mean that you can apply them to every person. And finally, in the case of Eved and Achai, just because you're very medaktic and the other person is not, does not necessarily mean that he's over on the other. It's a distortion of the situation. So you have those three things: distorting the situation, failure to be balanced up first, and failure to look into himself to see that perhaps the reason why he's focusing on a defect in somebody else may be because he's been self-protecting it. So those are the three things that perhaps Rashi's pointing out here. So what we're saying is a sense of projection. That let's say you have a certain defect. Instead of dealing with it, you just go around making a whole campaign criticizing others. But it's really a disguise, it's a mask. And it's an easy way of allowing you to avoid facing this within yourself. And then the appropriate punishment would be to put you in a situation where you have to face that very same thing that you accuse other people of doing. That's how I'm approaching it over here. I want to get back to something we said, I'm not sure if it was yesterday or the day before. We're trying to analyze the Nida Kneged Nida in terms of the Bibasam Ra that Yosef brought to his father. I think the pshat, the toughest one of all, as I said, was the fact that he was sold as an Eved, and that was because that was punishment for the fact that he reported that the brothers called the Bnei Ashpachos already. That was difficult because it's difficult to see the connection. So from that it would seem that he was concerned about the humiliation of the brothers. So why would he suffer that humiliation? Right? No, so I'm just repeating what I said, basically in a different way. That's first and foremost. By the way, that particular punishment, so to speak, that's the essential one. The essential flaw in his personality determined that he should be sold as an Eved. Not a particular thing that he told his father, but that particular one, more than anything else, reflects the essential flaw. Now, the essential flaw, from this you see have an insight into the essential flaw of Diva Ra, of someone who brings back bad reports. It's very clear over here. What is the essential flaw of one who brings back a bad report? The first thing is you shouldn't be concerned about what others are doing. Take a look at yourself. Take a look at yourself first. Now, there are many people that are very preoccupied with being critics of others and looking at others. And I'm not saying that there's no gain or purpose or whatever. I'm not going into that. But the first, when you're looking for fault, and the noise is koshu v'koshu. First correct hishkoshu v'atzmacha. First correct yourself, then correct others. The important idea. I would say, therefore, that Yosef over here was guilty of being involved in correcting others before he had corrected himself. And to the extent that you are involved in correcting others, to that extent you are not involved in correcting yourself. It's just the way the psyche works. Once a person becomes, that's his focus, is he working on helping others, so to speak, or he's criticizing others, then he's no longer looking at himself. And that's the central flaw In this particular case, what he was reproving the brothers for was that the brothers had a superior attitude of superiority towards the Bnei Hashvacha. They looked down on that. In other words, that idea that they felt superior. Well, it's possible that Yosef missed out on that in himself. That was his essential flaw. You see? Which dictated that he be sold as an eved. Because he did partake, to a certain extent, of a feeling of superiority, of vanity, on an emotional level. And that's something that has to be worked out. And it was worked out when he experienced the humiliation of being sold as an eved. But in that particular Diba, the Diba reflected the core defect of his personality that the Ashkacha determined that he had to work on. And that's what I said when I said Kala Posel and Mimumo Posel. It's a very important lesson. And that is to say that first and foremost, before you engage in criticizing others, make sure you've looked at yourself. And when you do find yourself criticizing others, then it should be an opportunity to do tshuva as well, because then inevitably you always look at yourself. What about me? And if a person does not engage, even when he's engaging in tochacha of somebody else, it should stimulate a process of introspection and look at yourself and see perhaps you too partake of that particular detail. So that's how I explain the Mida Keneged Mida with regard to the accusation against the brothers that they called the Bnei Hashvachos Avadim, so he was Nimkar L'Eved. And we said, but the real reason he was Nimkar L'Eved was because of something else. I'm saying that answers the question. But the main flaw was that feeling of overestimation, of superiority. And that is reflected in this particular aspect of the Diba. It's also reflected in all the other aspects. As he said, essentially the reason why the Diba wasn't accurate, was distorted to a certain extent, it was a distortion. As he said, by very severe standards. And he misjudged them, therefore. And that was a reflection of the basic sense of superiority. People who have a sense of superiority tend to be very, very harsh and lacking in mercy in judging others. When you judge others, you have to judge them with mishpat, with justice, and with mercy. Ironically, that's exactly what happened in his case, that the brothers judged him without the component of mercy. When the brothers judged him, they were laughing, and that's what they finally did tshuva to when they said, we saw the suffering of his soul, that he pleaded with us below Shamanu. In other words, the first level of tshuva, they didn't acknowledge that what they did was wrong, but rather the way in which they did it was wrong. That they judged him without a measure of compassion. Because when you judge a person, it's that there's two processes. One is abstract, did he do the act or didn't he do the act, guilty or innocent. But then there's the subjective context, given the person context, his nature, his temptations, his age, extenuating circumstances. So a person cannot be a judge if he's approached it purely as an abstract science. Like a scientist in the lab. He's got to have that capacity to evaluate the evidence, with that precision. But then, when he reaches the conclusion, he has to bear in mind that we're dealing here with a human being. And there's a context, and the objective of punishment and so on and so forth is not to destroy people, but if at all possible, to help them. So he has to bring to it a measure of compassion. And Yosef's mistake in judging the brothers or bringing them back the evil report reflected an attitude which was lacking in compassion. Ironically, he too suffered from the same thing. When the brothers dealt with him, they dealt with him in a manner which was lacking in compassion. I'm not saying, it's interesting, me to connect with me or whether it is, but sometimes it's just a natural result. Sometimes the natural result of the way you deal with others is that, they will deal with you in the very same way. The main reason why he was sold was because he had a certain defect, okay? Rashi is saying he was in Kala Eved because of the fact that he said that the brothers called him, the Yash Brothers. I'm saying that the two go hand in hand. that that particular diva was reflective of his general defect. Also, you could say, if you want, you could say like this, that the general problem required that he be humiliated. But why in this specific way? There's many ways in which a person can be humiliated. But it turned out that specifically, exactly, you see, in the way that reflecting, right, the sin that he committed by reporting back on the brothers. What we're saying is like this, is that why does Rashi have to go into the diva from Ra and go into the specific? Why not just leave it? It's important because the Pasuk does tell us this about Yosef, that he brought back an evil report. And that's something that requires further explanation. I mean, that's clearly a defect. Right? But what kind of a defect is it? I mean, usually people do this for very base motives. And it's dangerous then if you're gonna read it that Yosef, you know, just like to gossip and bring and snitch on people and bring people down, so then that's going to distort our picture of Yosef and Zatara. It's got to fit into the context. So then Rashi has to tell you that what he did wasn't just ordinary gossip. He was talking about serious things. What he saw when he encountered the brothers, what he saw was things that were quite serious. That is to say, Eiv Menachai, Arayos, right, mistreating the Vashbachos, all these are very serious things. But if that's the case, then you're going to have a problem, so what about the brothers, and what kind of people were they? So therefore, there's a balancing act you have to do, and that's what we did, right? Mr. Zacham bounces up. But it's all indicative of the same thing. The Diva Roa stems from one thing. It stems from a certain complacency about yourself, a certain overconfidence about yourself, a certain overestimation of yourself. I can't quantify it any more than that, just in general, you see? And that's why, in all of these areas, we're saying that the brothers really were not guilty in an overt fashion, and Yosef misjudged them, the top goal. That's basically the central problem. It's expressed in three different ways, you see? But there is one of them which goes to the heart of Diva. And that is that in Diva, when a person does focus on another person's defects, then that should trigger off in his own mind, he should look at himself. Now, with regard to the Eiv Menachai, and with regard to the Arayos, it doesn't mean that Yosef had that particular flaw. You see? It just means to say that he was overly harsh in his expectations of others. He wasn't sympathetic to their weaknesses. However, with regard to the accusation of how they treated the brothers, there's something else. There you have the primary evil or defect of Lashon Hara, and that is that a person chooses to look at other people's faults and thereby bypassing his own. In other words, look at yourself first. So I'm saying you have two different elements over there. That would explain why the specific onus, the onus is very, very specific. Not just in general, but very specific that he be sold as an eved, exactly what he accused the brothers of doing to the Vash Bachar. For the fact that he failed to look into himself and see whether maybe he partook of that same nida that he was accusing them of. That's something, you see? That's something that's a very important lesson, that a person who speaks Lashon Hara, he should look into himself and see that maybe he partakes. Because when you're talking about somebody else, that's exactly what you're saying. He's guilty, I'm not. It's a means of whitewashing yourself. That's the essential defect, flaw in Lashon Hara. To sum up, Lashon Hara involves three things. First of all, it involves a failure to look at yourself. Secondly, when you're looking at somebody else, it's a failure to be balanced up close. And thirdly, it is a distortion. It causes a positive distortion. And that if people are not being machmir according to the way you think they should, you automatically brand them as being sinners. Okay, so now let's proceed to the second dream. Vayachal amod chalom acher, and he dreamed yet another dream. Vayisafer oso li'echav, and he told it over to his brothers. By Yomer he said, "Nei chalamti chalamod." I dreamed another dream. The Hinei Hashemesh by Yerech, and the sun and the moon, the Achad Asat Ocham, and the 11 stars, Mishtachavim Li, were bowing down to me. By Yitzhakar Alavu V'Yalechav, and he told it to his father and to his brothers. By Yigar Alavu, and his father rebuked him. By Yom Elo, and he said to him, Moha Chalom Azeh Asher Chalomta. What is this dream that you dream? Avon Navo, I knew the Imcha V'Yasecha. Shall I and your mother and your brother come L'Shtach Lo Shachar Arza to bow down to you? By Yitanu Bo Echad, and his brothers were jealous of him. The others fell in Asa Dala, and his father guarded the matter. So this is the last piece of information we're given prior to the... In other words, here the Torah has completed a statement of the causes, which resulted in the hatred, the hostility that they had to Yosef and the subsequent Mechila. What are the problems over here? First thing, why did he tell the brothers at all? The brothers. I mean, it seems that he made a big mistake in telling the first thing. Right? We said that the reason why he told the first thing was because he regarded it as being significant and serious. It wasn't, again, he didn't do it just to provoke anger. That doesn't make sense. In his own mind, he was doing it for the right reason, because he regarded it as serious. And if it were true, then it was something that the brothers needed to know. In other words, the fact that Hashgach had designated him to be the leader. But he had met with a very bad reception. The brothers were not happy to hear this. They rebuked him. Amar of Timroch Aleinu? Amar Shal Timshal Banu? And then they hated him even more. So matters got exceedingly worse. One would think then that the second dream that he had would be he keeps himself. What's the point? Yet he's extremely persistent. Okay, that's the first question. The second question is that this second dream he tells twice. First he tells it over to the brothers by themselves without the father. Then he tells it over to Yaakov in the presence of his father. Well, of course, the question is why did he do that? Also, what is the difference between the first dream and the second dream? That's another question. It seems to be pretty much the same idea, just expressed in a different way. Was there anything different in it? Okay? Now we have to understand the reaction of Yaakov. You know, what motivated that particular reaction? What was he trying to accomplish, and did he accomplish it? And then, of course, the question that you fellows have asked on your Aleph, why were they jealous? What was this jealousy about? Well, how does jealousy fit into the picture? When they heard the first thing, it produced a reaction of hatred. Now, you see, folks, that we understand, but where does the jealousy come into the picture? Just because somebody has a dream. Just because somebody has a dream, which they didn't agree with. What he should have done, it seems to me, either two choices, either not to say it over to anyone, because why was it necessary? I mean, he didn't have an avuah that he should tell it over to anybody. He just said that it was the dream itself. But if anything, he would have told it, I would have told it to Yaakov, just Yaakov. Yaakov, he only told after he told the brothers. He brings Yaakov, for the first time, he brings Yaakov into the picture. And Yaakov rebukes him severely. Important, as I say, because it would seem that this is the final element that, so to speak, feels the faith in terms of the brothers. After this, there's nothing further. The next thing we read about is that fateful day when he goes to, you know, the father Yaakov sends him. I mean, that's also a problem, why Yaakov sends him out there. And he falls into their hands, and nothing else happens to cause them to want to destroy him. As soon as they see him, like, it's not what it's all on Israel. Then immediately, they begin to think about how they're going to kill him. So apparently, apparently this was very significant. Even with the first dream, had he kept quiet about the second dream, then they would have hated him, but they would not have wanted to kill him. So this dream is crucial to complete the series of causes that led to that decision. See that he appears in the dream, personally, this is a background to him, so apparently it's him. He appears in the dream. And then you have the sun, the moon, etc. But on the surface, it doesn't seem to matter because in the first thing, it's bundles, and the brother's got the point. The interpretation of the dream was that Hamalapsim Machalena. So what difference does it make? What difference does it make how it's expressed in the dream? What you're really concerned about is what the dream represents in the mind of the dreamer. And to them it represents a desire for power. But Rashi on Yud says, after he told his brothers, he went ahead and he told it to his father in their presence. That's a bit strange, because if he wanted to tell it to both, he should have done that immediately. Alright, take a look at Rashi and Havo Nevo. The rebuke, which tries to explain the rebuke. It's interesting the manner in which he starts to rebuke him. What does it mean? So Rashi says, at this point in time, his mother was dead, as you know. She died when Binyamin was there. So apparently the sun and the moon is a reference to the parents, right? The sun being the father and the moon being the mother. Which is interesting in its own way. I know, it's interesting to study that analogy to see what it tells us about the concept of father and mother. That's just a side point. That means it's not just by accident. There's a point here. He says like this, that the rebuke was that the stream is obviously full. Because his mother was dead. But he didn't know, let's say Yaakov didn't know, that the Yaakov was wrong, according to his chest. That Vara Magiyim of Bilhah, that the was true, but it referred to Bilhah. Bilhah was like a stepmother. She Yidalko to Imam. Bilhah was Yishivcha, right, of Leah. Of Rachel. And she raised Yaakov, and she raised Yosef as though she was the mother. So then Yaakov was wrong. But the way Yaakov understood it referred to the moon was a reference to the mother, and that's false. And therefore the dream is false. But Yaakov was wrong, because the dream was true, because the mother doesn't have to mean the biological mother. So for all practical purposes it referred to Bilhah, who was his stepmother, and then in that sense the dream is true. That's the first job. So I was saying along the time, the Chazal learned from here, she ain't chalom below Dvarim B'Telem, that there is no dream without the Dvarim B'Telem. That is, without untrue matters, without matters that are untrue. In other words, it says, even a prophetic dream, not every element has to be true in the prophetic dream. You have a problem with this, right? It's hard to square both Shatan. Because, in other words, like this, if you say that he didn't have a mother, and that part is wrong, okay, that doesn't refer to anybody else. There's no one else. Let's say there was no stepmother, okay, at the time. So the only person it could refer to was Rachel, and therefore it's false. It's vulnerable. So then you can draw the conclusion that even though the entire dream was a prophetic dream, but even a prophetic dream can contain elements which are drawn to the elements. But if you're going to tell me that it wasn't drawn to the elements, that it was a reference to Bilhah, so therefore it's true, so then how do you derive from here that there's income? Maybe there's never a dream with drawn to the elements. It always doesn't happen. But, you know what I mean? These two chapters seem to contradict each other. There's two different opinions. that Chazal didn't do that. They raised the Rabbi Chazal and Rabbi Seinah Chazal, and there's the Machlokes. But they didn't agree with that it's a reference. In other words, the question is like this: does he reference the reference to the moon, which clearly everybody agrees is a reference to the parents, because in that context, you know, you have the 11 stars representing brothers, so it's the family, and the sun and the moon. So the sun is clearly the father, the moon is clearly the mother. So according to that, the question now is, does the moon refer to the actual mother, or can it refer to one who functioned as a mother? So there's one opinion that holds that it can refer to the functional mother. If that's the case, you can't deduce from their interpretation that it didn't make sense on all points. But Chazal disagrees, and they say that it doesn't make sense. That in that type of phenomenon, it can refer to the actual mother. You can't apply it to somebody else. So therefore, how do you account for the fact that the dream is both true and yet contains something which is false? So then they propounded their theory that Ein Chalom believes Van Betel. That's what the, take a look at the Sivri Chachamim. The Sivri Chachamim, Os Aleph. Okay? Shehein Sovim, Shapir Imcha, that they held that the explanation of Imcha, Eno Nofel, Ela Ali Nomash, can only apply to someone who is actually his mother. Alright? So in this case it's false. Ela, but you must say, Shehein Chalom, below Dvam Tel. So now you have a new position. We have to explain that position of Ein Chalom below Dvam Tel. Okay. Forget about the Rashi. From the Pesukim itself, forget about the next, that's a very tough topic to understand. You see, when you study Chumash, you have to realize what's difficult about Chumash is that the Torah describes things very often in a vague kind of a way. It's not written that precisely like a Tosfos. Quite the contrary, we wish it would be written more specifically. What exactly? So it leaves room. The Chumash, the narrative, very often leave a great deal of room for interpretation. What exactly is happening? It's not clear from the story itself. That's why I said many times, it's not a self-contained work. A person cannot, just reading the text itself, it's very difficult. You can posit all kinds of theories, but how do you know whether they make any sense or not? You can read the story and very easily come to the conclusion that Yaakov rejected it. Even with the pasuk of Shamar Tadala. Because that's a very strange way of putting it, isn't that? It's a very strange thing to say. He guarded the matter. You know what he's talking about. Guarded what matter? What does that mean? How does that fit in? It's a very tough pasuk. The purpose of Yaakov was to defuse the situation. His essential purpose over here, it's not even necessary what he believes or did. That's why the prophet tells you in the next prophet what he personally believed. His action over here, he displayed anger against Yosef. His purpose was to defuse the tension. He sensed what was happening. And his purpose was to try and defuse the situation, the animosity, by rebuking him for having these dreams. In other words, by siding with the brother, so to speak, that it's nonsense. That this is nonsense. And then Rashi, of course, the whole thing is nonsense. And if you want to take it literally, the Imcha, you see it's nonsense, because your mother is not even alive. So the whole dream, in other words, he goes even further, he doesn't just rebuke him, like the brothers rebuke him. The brothers rebuke him, that you have these visions of grandeur. You want to rule over us. But Yaakov rebukes him more with a specific to show that this is foolishness. Obviously, take a look at Rashi. The Yaakov nistarim mahotia davni leiv bano, and Yaakov's intention was to remove the issue from the heart of the son. Shalom, yikanu. They shouldn't be envious of him. The kach avarav on ever. In other words, what he's saying is that this is absurd. Do you think that we're going to come and bow down to you? And then he shows specifically that just like it's impossible, I mean, yeah, Yaakov tried to go very far to show that this is foolishness. But just like it's impossible with your mother, it's just impossible with us. Now, we have to ask ourselves, we know what the intention of Yaakov was. And apparently, did it succeed or didn't it succeed? It seems like it did not succeed. It doesn't seem like it succeeded because it says, Vayikanu bo'acha. So what are the envious of? We have a lot of questions over here. What were they envious of? Why did Yaakov fail to achieve his objective? It seems to be, and once Yosef decided to bring it before Yaakov, whom they all respected, Yaakov was the focal point, he was the focus. They came to Yaakov, and Yaakov rejected it. And said, Yavo Nevo. And beyond the point of Rashi, it's Von the Caleb. He refuted it. So, it seems like a pretty good, that seems to be a good move on the part of Yaakov. Yaakov finally has realized this is serious and he's better do something about it. And yet, it doesn't seem that he succeeded. Because immediately afterwards, I mean, we have to ask ourselves, if Yaakov was aware of the danger, why would he send Yosef out and put them in the, you know, the jaws of the lion, so to speak? But also, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't seem to do the job. If anything, it makes matters worse. Now he's finished. Now Yosef is finished. Rambam says, in answer to Lev's question, his question, was Yaakov aware of Dream 1? According to Rambam, he was not. And the reason he didn't tell it to him, and this is a very important Rambam, the reason he didn't tell him was because he understood the Pisron on his own. He didn't need his father. But in this one, he wasn't sure, apparently. This would indicate, and according to Rambam, one of the reasons he had to tell him was because he simply didn't want the Pisron. But that's difficult because then why would he tell the brother? Why wouldn't he go straight to the father? Take a look at the Ramban on Yud. He told this dream to his father and not the first one because he personally understood his interpretation. Okay? Because the Shemesh referred to his father. So who garbo? And he was the victim. No, the first one didn't contain the father. According to Ramban. That's what it means. Straight. In other words, Yosef understood the Pisron of both. Now it was only the first time. Yosef understood the Pisron. So the first dream he only told to the brothers because it didn't concern Yaakov doesn't appear in that dream. But the second dream he tells to his father and the brothers because it concerned the brothers. That would explain why he has two. It's interesting. That's why he might explain why he tells it twice, by the way. Agavurkid might explain why he tells it twice. Because there are two parties in the dream. There's the brothers, and then there's the father, Yaakov. And Yosef recognized that. So it could be that first he tells it to the brothers, because it concerns them in their own right. And then he tells it to them in the presence of Yaakov, because it concerns Yaakov, when it concerns Yaakov, it's Yaakov and the brothers. I mean, it's like a, you know, it's a combination, so to speak. I'm sorry? So, Sam is asking, well, why not both at once? What's the difference? Why do you have to accept the telling for the brothers just because it concerns them separately? Good question. I corrected myself. I misread the Ramban. Eli had it right. The time, the Alecha of Tom Shemesh. And the reason why he told to his brothers a second time, yeah, because, okay, he could have been, there's another alternative, for whatever reason, he could have told to his brothers, then he could have just told to Yaakov. So why does he have to tell to the brothers twice? Okay? He told to his father, he told to his father in the presence of his brother. Okay, that's what it means. It doesn't tell you why. I think it's a good idea though. Assuming, we don't know, alright, we still have your question, but assuming that he wanted to tell it to the brothers first, and then he wanted to tell it to Yaakov, it makes sense to have the brothers present, so that they will witness the reaction of Yaakov. Otherwise, they would suspect him, you know, they wouldn't trust him, they wouldn't believe him. So therefore, he had to have them present when he told it to Yaakov. Who goroso, and he refused him, l'shachech hamasom, to weaken their anger, may Allah, to remove the anger, to cause the anger to dissipate. So that's clearly what his intention was.
Why would
he
do that? Why would
he
do that?
Yeah, so, then we get to make a kasha. I mean, did Yaakov believe it was true, or didn't he? If he believed it was false, okay. So then he, the rebuke is well founded. But if Yaakov believes it was true, so then why didn't he tell him? Tell his brothers that it's true. Now, we all assume now that they're all shit they saw. They're high-level people, and they're going to follow Nebuah, they're going to follow their father. And that's probably why Yosef went to Yaakov in the first place, to get the stuff. So if Yaakov held that it was true, he should have told him. Excellent question. There's something very important that we have to understand. I mean, Yaakov was attempting to defuse the situation, and clearly he failed. We're going to try to understand why, how so, we have to learn from it. Now, V'tan moch alom azeh ashech alamta. What does it mean? What is this dream that you've dreamed? I mean, such a funny expression. What is this dream? I dreamed it. It's the dream that I told you. What kind of question is that? He says, Kamal ma adam vatei ga'ei, which is the language of the stars. What is it? In other words, it's like making a statement. Kaloma ma kaloma ga, what is it? What is this dream? Ain't no clue. It's nonsense. It's nothing. No, he's trying to disparage it by saying, what is this dream? This is what you tell us. This is nonsense. The EML Dvarim B'Talim. It's just Dvarim B'Talim. It's nonsense. It's foolishness. Otam Hagar, or the idea behind the rebuke, Lomar, is to say, if Nisach HaLidfa, Rachalom HaChalom Hagar. It's a different approach. How do you allow yourself to even have to dream? Now, this goes to the heart of the question that I raise. I mean, how can you get angry at a person for having a dream? Is that question? It's unacceptable. We never would condemn a person for having a dream, because it's not something out of your control. But yet, here he is. What are you crazy? How can you have a dream like this? Very no. He gives a different shot. Ramban is very interesting. Ramban says like this: that he is condemning him for having a dream, because your dreams do indicate a certain reflection. If you've allowed yourself to reach such a point, then if you're having these kind of dreams, that's a serious flaw. This is nothing but gaiva, holiness, venara, and childishness. In other words, it's a childish kind of vanity. It's a serious flaw. This is basically what we're saying about the Yosef Olam. So Yahweh Zvon to Eid of Alukha, that these things will come. In other words, even what a person considers, and apparently even what a person dreams about, according to this Shah Ramban, does his blood on it. Of course, we know that it does. In a purely psychological sense, in a Freudian sense, that's different. You see, that's different. But apparently, it's an interesting idea that Ramban is saying. No. Not a Freudian. Because that I disagree with. In the Freudian sense, you're talking about really unconscious. You're really speaking about unconscious wishes. So that, By and large, if a person were to have a dream in which he does some horribly evil kind of thing, I mean, let's ask ourselves that question, where a person really, attacks someone and tears them to shreds, or does something really horrible. But it's just a dream. He's a good person. I mean, when he reports that dream, like those moments before you wake up, you feel terribly guilty. My God, how did I do that? So like this, though. In that case, where a person dreams that he did something horrible, I don't know that you condemn the person, because that's something which is stemming from his unconscious. You can't recognize him. The reason why it strikes you as being so grotesque is because you can't recognize yourself in the dream. That's not me. That's something I don't do. I don't even want to do. The only thing we do say is that you're really in a sense it is you, because you just don't know your nature well enough. There's an unconscious part of you. Yeah, but you don't condemn a person to be unconscious. We just said that you should be in touch with it. You should, to the extent that you can understand it. But then I can't say it's your fault. Ramban is saying something very interesting, and that he's saying that in this case he was rebuking him, that the very fact that you have to dream is a fault of yours. How could he thought Ola Alipcha? How could he even think of a thing like that? Well, one second, that depends. If a person has like a dream, like a conscious dream. This is my dream, but it's a conscious dream. To be the ruler and to have this And then you were to tell over these dreams, then I could see the review. And it shows you how far removed you are from reality, even thinking this way. Only a person, when a person envisions himself, they start fantasizing about being the ruler of a country, and really has these dreams that I want to be. And then you look at the person, he's just an ordinary individual, so this is so far removed, and you say, well, what's wrong with you? And even your fantasies are crazy. What we said yesterday was that the brothers got upset with him, not for having a dream, but for taking it seriously. The fact that you take such a dream seriously, you tell it over to people, and you know, in your mind it indicates something. That I understand. But I don't know if that's what the Ramban is saying. He quotes two sources from the Nehru, which I just looked up. Bayan Chal Mishkav Chasaliko, Vehirhuin Al Mishkavi. In both cases, in other words, he's telling them that your thought, your true thoughts occur to you in your bed, meaning in a dream. Vehirhuin, your thoughts, my thoughts, Al Mishkavi, on my bed. It's just worth the reference if you look at the context. I was just looking up the context in Bania. Now, what he's saying, therefore, is that sometimes in a dream expresses a person's real thoughts. Expresses a person's real thoughts, and it is, to a certain extent, an accurate reflection of what he thinks about things. There's two kinds of dreams. According to the second shot in the Ramban, it means like this. That there are two kinds of dreams. There are certain dreams which you clearly cannot hold the person responsible for. I mean, because they clearly stem from forces beyond his control, unconscious wishes. I mean, see, a person is, you know, a peaceful individual and so on and so forth, and then he has these murderous dreams, but that's not him. It's not stemming from anything he's doing consciously. Certain elements in the unconscious. So therefore, you cannot blame him. You do know that there are certain dreams that you would be upset with a person. Let's say a person had dreams in which he was having some kind of an affair with a married woman, right? Well, let's say the person told you about that. The person said that he's been having these dreams in which he's having an affair with that person's wife. There, the person might be upset with him. Now, there, I say there's two possibilities. It could be because you're entertaining these notions a great deal, instead of suppressing them properly, you're allowing yourself to entertain certain notions, so that's why you're having these dreams. In other words, it's possible that certain things appear in a dream, certain elements appear in a dream, and because you're attributing, you know, power to them, force to them, reality to them in your waking life. What the Ramban is saying over here, as Yaakov was saying, is that if you were truly a humble person, if you had a true estimate of yourself, you never even have dreamed like this. And a humble person doesn't dream this way. And it's because of you are not sufficiently humble, and you have these thoughts occupy a great deal of your energy, these thoughts of being a ruler, these thoughts of grandeur, and it's only because of that you know I can explain having a dream like this. And that's what he was saying. That I think is feasible. In that sense, a person, so there's no guilt in the dream itself, obviously. But in other words, you've got to look back on your life. And the fact that you're having this dream shows that you've been preoccupied with these types of thoughts, with these types of ambitions. So that's a defect. He's criticizing for that. That is the second interpretation of Ma Chalom. Hazeh Asher Chalomta. In other words, in the first interpretation, he was disparaging the dream itself. It's complete and utter nonsense. In the second interpretation, he was gone beyond that and disparaging Yosef, the person, for even having such a dream. It's a different focus. Of course, in the second one, it includes the idea that the dream is nonsense, but it's not limited to that. It's going beyond that, and it is really an attack upon Yosef. You see? Eich nesoch alevcha. There's something wrong with you. How could you have a dream like that? How could you allow yourself? The only possible interpretation is that you're suffering from a defect. That you're suffering from the defect of Gaiva. Look at this, as we say, the idea in general, by and large, that a person is not responsible for his dreams. Of course, you see, the Torah does hold a person responsible for certain kinds of dreams, which stem from Hirhurim, as you know. You know, sexual fantasy, and then a person has a sexual dream, or he's he has Kelly, Shifra Zerah Vato. That's a halachic violation. Of course, the violation is not in the actual event in the dream when you're asleep, but it's to allow you to put yourself into that situation where you will have such a dream. You're hurim. But clearly, there's certainly a category of dreams which come about because of the thoughts, the waking thoughts that a person has been involved in. You see? He has aroused, what does it mean there? What does it mean? It means he's aroused certain desires which are now, he goes to sleep unfulfilled, and in sleep, these dreams will have a way of fulfilling themselves and bring them to a violation of Shechva Zalatot. Now that is not too distant then. In the same way, what Yaakov was saying is that these aren't normal dreams. This is not normal. It expresses the fact that there are certain desires that you have. But where did these desires come from? Oh, because you've entertained these thoughts, you've aroused all of these desires and put yourself in a situation so that this dream is now an expression of the fulfillment of those desires. For that, you're guilty. In page 453 of the English Ramban, the Rabbi Shavel, the footnote, so he quotes the passage from Daniel, and he says like this, he quotes it literally, the thoughts you entertained during the day came with you to bed and you dreamed about them. See, I'm saying this is why the Ramban would make sense, that's the phenomenon, that it requires a little bit further explanation. It doesn't mean, because a lot of times things you're thinking about during the day, you don't think about it now. You can be involved in thinking about business, you can be involved in studies, you can be involved in ideas, and you don't think about those ideas at night. It doesn't mean, it's not a simple thing that whatever thought, I don't view it that way, that whatever thought that you're thinking about during the day, you'll think about it at night. But what it means is, though, I think what I've explained, like your ruin. The thoughts you had during the day aroused certain needs within you, certain emotions. But you didn't satisfy those desires. So that when you went to bed, you went to bed with emotions that had been aroused and were unfulfilled. And then there is the mechanism of dreams, which is a secondary method of satisfying desires through the mechanism of a dream. That everybody acknowledges. So that could happen in a sexual area. It could also happen in an egotistical area. And that's the way I understand the Ramban. That you're guilty because the thoughts you have during the day have aroused powerful desires that are unfulfilled in real life, so now they're being fulfilled in a dream. But since you're totally destroyed, you're giving credence to the dream. So that is the Ga'ara, the rebuke of Yaakov, according to the Ramban. But just to further elucidate that point, according to Allah, you can be culpable for a dream. Okay? And, for example, the classical case is the case where a person is moved to Shechva Zerah Vatolah in a dream, and it is due to the fact that he aroused a certain sexual thought during the daytime. That's the point that I made before. Now it is true that when you go to sleep and when you actually have a dream, a sexual kind of a dream, it leads to Shechva Zerah Vatolah. But at that point in time, you're not morally responsible. Because you're not in a waking state. You have no conscious control. You don't have free will. But, since that is a result of the kind of thoughts you were involved in during the day, which was subject to your free will, you see, then you're guilty for putting yourself into a situation where that inevitably has to occur. For a person has to not only refrain from the activities which are prohibited, but he has to refrain from all of those things which lead to those conclusions. So double, by the way. I was just funny yesterday, my fellow. And then I'll elucidate more in different times, but you see the whole essence, the person wants to lead a moral life, a truly moral life, then he has to avoid temptation. In other words, people are destroyed. Most people are destroyed. People who profess to be committed to principles, morality, ethics, and so forth, and then you see that they get caught up in scandals and so forth. The truth of the matter is that they wanted to avoid certain activities, but they could not free themselves from their fascination, and they allow their emotions to be aroused. The key to leading a truly moral life, and I don't mean by moral, I mean just for the sake of avoiding, you know, sure, like, oh, I mean, our goal is by say so, to redirect the energy towards the good. But the key is to avoid the fascination with that which is illicit, so to speak, with that which is with the prohibited, with evil. And the truth that's totally different, though. Man is fascinated with evil. The truth is, I could prove it to all these people, I mean, even the Zulim, you know, very highly advanced people, but the truth is, why do people read novels? Why do people go to movies? There's a tremendous fascination. That fascination remains. And as long as you have that fascination, so that you wouldn't do those things that you're watching, but you're fascinated with them. And that means to say that the energy is really attracted to certain types of things. Now, of course, obviously that's okay, not perfection, but perfection, ultimately, you have to remove yourself from any type of situation of temptation. When a person puts himself into a state of temptation, he's risking his life. He's risking his life. And that's the whole direction of the halachic system. The Elisha Benidas Tumasa Lo Sikra Veyla. Lo Sikra Veyla. Lagala Tavata. And so, I mean, either the Rambam learns that Lo Sikra is itself a Lo Sikra. Okay. But even if you hold that it's not, in other words, I would need to say that any type of kirov for a sexual purpose, then, even if it doesn't need to be a, according to the Rambam, is a low thought in the director. Now, there's a case where the Torah actually incorporated the philosophy into the structure of the system of mitzvot. But the whole, even if you don't learn that it could be a right to Venice Rabbana, I mean, everybody met many things as the Rabbana, for sure, too. But the Torah is making, if that's the case, of what the Torah says. Because the real perfection is not simply to avoid the action, but it's to avoid the kirov. Kirov means that's where your energy is drawing you. That's your hurei avera. Your hurei avera, Chazal says, worse than the other. I mean, your hurei avera, that's where it's at. I mean, the real perfection lies in not just refraining from certain things, but refraining from the fascination. A person can refrain, give them a whole life of restraint, but the fascination, his mental fascination is with that which is evil. So then he's really speaking the world of evil, even though he's not doing the evil action. And the avoidance of evil is only for the sake of Asay Tov, to pave the way for Asay Tov. So the only way to lead a truly moral life is to extricate yourself from situations of temptation. You'll see, all the cases where a person has fallen and is committing an error, it's always been because he allowed that temptation. He never started out with the intention of doing an error. But he puts himself into a state of temptation. And once he's in a state of temptation, then could be he'll get out of it. Then, but now he's at the mercy of forces beyond his control. You see? So that is the secret. That's the secret. Okay. So getting back into the chalamos, if that is the case, then a person will be culpable for certain types of dreams, because these dreams are a natural result of the thought that he's engaged in during the day. And yeah, that's important. One time he was sheer on the whole concept of sheer smalamita, sheer smalamita. The purpose. But the state of mind in which a person goes to sleep in is very significant in terms of affecting. Because sleep is a situation where all of his instincts, the instinctual part of man, now comes to the fore. It can have an effect upon it, the conscious part. So therefore, the conscious can have an impact upon the unconscious. But that's a separate shiur. Getting back over here, the Ramban makes the point that one interpretation is ma chalama de'asher chalamta. So he's being rebuked for the dream. Because he's saying that, well, I mean, so, because you have to defend yourself, what's it my fault? I just dreamed that this is the dream, that the sun and the moon and the 11 stars are down past me. But what Yaakov was saying was that a person can't just not have a dream like that. You know, it would be like